the front of the cart. The toddler was a boy. The baby was swaddled in a pink fleece sack, her face obscured. "Hey, Claire." Cash said it casually, as though he'd just seen her the week before. He felt like he'd just seen her the week before, because he and Baker had spent so much time talking about her. The good news was that the bad mojo of Claire Bellows had been exorcised. Cash felt nothing when he looked at her. He leaned in to kiss her cheek. "How are you?"
"This is like that song," Claire exclaimed. "Met my old lover in the grocery store. The snow was falling Christmas Eve."
Cash nodded along, trying to be a good sport. The lyrics rang a distant bell. Gordon Lightfoot, maybe? Simon and Garfunkel? Cash was reminded that Claire used to be a lyrics wizard, especially when it came to the music of their parents' era, because Claire's mother, Adrienne Bellows, was a disc jockey on the local easy listening station. When Cash and Claire were in high school, Adrienne worked the evening 6-10 shift. She was Eastern Iowa's answer to Delilah. While Adrienne Bellows was comforting the heartbroken and lovelorn who called in with their requests and sappy dedications, Cash and Claire were making out and, eventually, having sex in Claire's bedroom.
"And who do we have here?"
Cash asked in an attempt to be gallant. He was trying, he really was. Claire looked confused until she realized he meant the children.
"Oh," she said, "this is Eugene, and the baby is Mabel."
Cash tried not to grimace. Claire had followed the trend of naming her children as though they'd been born 120 years ago.
"Nice," he said. "Hi, guys."
The toddler turned to look at Cash, missing the eggs by a fraction of an inch, and Cash couldn't help himself. He moved the carton to safety.
"So you're back in Iowa City?"
"Temporarily," Claire said. "For the next 5 or 6 years. My husband is doing a fellowship in endocrinology at the university."
Cash nearly said, "And you?" But he was afraid Claire would tell him that she'd given up her job as a marketing executive with Colgate-Palmolive in Chicago in order to follow her husband back to Iowa, and then add that she was okay with it, or else openly express bitterness. To extract himself from that awkward topic, Cash would then ask about her mother, and Claire, realizing that she was doing all the talking, would take the reins and say, "What about you? Why are you in town?" Cash could then say he was visiting his parents, which would be half a lie, although lying would be preferable to telling Claire that Russ was dead. Claire had loved Russ. She and Russ had a thing where they told each other knock-knock jokes, which Cash had found annoying even at the height of his passion for Claire. "Knock-knock. Who's there?" "A broken pencil." "A broken pencil who?" "Never mind, it's pointless." He might be able to successfully evade the topic of his parents, but there would undoubtedly be follow-up questions about where he was living and what he was doing. And then finally, as if it had just occurred to her for no particular reason, Claire would ask about Baker. To avoid that inevitable moment, Cash smiled at Claire and said,
"Well, at least Iowa City is a good place to raise kids. We learned that firsthand. See you later, Claire."
"But wait," Claire said.
Cash did not wait. He sacrificed the half a pound of sliced turkey on Irene's list and sauntered off in the direction of the bakery. Claire had always been socially awkward in a sweet way. When Baker hit on her at that frat party at Northwestern, it must have been like taking candy from a baby. But really, what did Cash care? He was over it. Thinking about it now in the Pullman Diner, he can't imagine spending 2 to 3 months here in Iowa City dodging landmines like his ex-girlfriend Claire. To Irene, he says,
"I'm going to stay a few days longer, at least."
She gives him a tight smile, and Cash wonders if maybe she wants him gone.
"Let's order," she says.
He's nearly asleep, sprawled across the massive acreage of the guest room bed, when he gets a text on his phone. Who would be texting him so late? Cash figures it must be Dylan again, telling Cash that he left his one hitter behind the counter, or complaining because he's still owed for a day and a half of work. The first thing Cash notices when he picks up his phone is the time. It's not late at all. It's only 10 o'clock. It just feels late because it gets dark at 4:30 in the afternoon, and there's nothing to do in this town after the dinner hour. The second thing Cash notices is that the text is from Ayers. Ayers. Cash stares at the phone, wondering if it's a trick. Did Baker somehow figure out a way to send Cash a text that looks like it's from Ayers? Cash hesitates a moment, then swipes to open. The text isn't a text, but rather a link. And when Cash clicks on the link, it opens to the website for Treasure Island Cruises, day trips to the BVIs, St. Thomas, Water Island, and beyond. Beyond? Cash thinks. Beyond must be that place you visit in your mind after 9 or 10 painkillers. This section of the website starts with Join the Treasure Island Crew. In smaller print beneath that is, We are currently seeking a first mate for our BVI routes. Must possess strong administrative skills and CPR and life-saving certification. Must enjoy working with people. Valid passport required, boating experience preferred. To apply, contact Ayers Wilson, Ayers at treasureislandcruisesvi.com. Did Ayers send this to him for a reason? Cash wonders. Does she think he should apply? He has been boating exactly once in the past 10 years, when he went on Treasure Island as Ayers' guest. Yes, he'd enjoyed it, and yes, Ayers had asked him if he wanted a job. But that had been a joke, right? And yet now, apparently, they were looking for someone. CPR certification he has. Life-saving, not a chance. Unless you considered avalanche rescue certification life-saving. Well, it was, but it wouldn't help him save someone who was drowning. Cash is an okay swimmer, and he does have years of experience working with people. But in his heart, he's a mountain boy. His thumbs hover over the keypad. It doesn't matter why Ayers sent this. It only matters that she's reaching out. She's thinking of him. He lies back in bed and tries to lasso his bucking bronco of a heart. Ayers had been so angry the last time he saw her, so indignant that two people she'd befriended had deceived her about who they were and what they were doing on St. John. In retrospect, Cash doesn't blame her. They, meaning Baker, should have told Ayers who they were at Rosie's funeral lunch. But okay, let's say that would have been in poor taste, fine. Cash should have told her who he was when he bumped into her on the Reef Bay Trail. No excuses. He should have and he hadn't. And then, once he'd spent the day with her aboard Treasure Island, he'd become infatuated with her and didn't want to ruin his chances. The same had been true for Baker. And guess what? They both lost out. Ayers told them she had gotten back together with her old boyfriend, Mick. Cash reads the link she'd texted him again. She must have sent it to him because she thought it would be a good fit, right? Right? Or maybe it was a joke. For all Ayers knows, Cash is back in Colorado, skiing the bowl on Peak 8. But he's not. He's in Iowa City without a job, without prospects. He closes his eyes and tries to imagine a life on the water. With Ayers, he would agree to live in the space station if it was with Ayers. He decides not to respond to the text right away. He wants to sleep on it. In the morning, the text is still there, and Cash is proud of himself for exercising restraint and not sending a knee-jerk response. Winnie is asleep at the foot of the bed. When she feels Cash stir, she lifts her head. You liked St. John, right? Cash asks. Wanna go back? Of course, it's not Winnie's permission that he needs. Cash pads down to the kitchen in his pajama bottoms and a decade-old social distortion t-shirt he found in the bureau in his room. Irene is juicing oranges the old-fashioned way,
by crushing the hell out of the buggers with a galvanized steel juicer that had belonged to her own mother. Cash watches her as she presses and twists the orange under her palms. All of that energy for a dribble of juice. Though it's probably not the worst way to release pent-up frustration.
Mom, he says, I'm not going back to Colorado.
You're not? She says, relaxing her death grip on the orange in her hand and then tossing the rind in the sink.
With your permission, he says.
His voice sticks. Asking her this is harder than he thought it would be.
I'd like to go back down.
Down, she says, though he can tell she understands.
To St. John, Cash says.
He clears his throat.
I have a lead on a job there. And I was hoping I could just stay in the villa.
Irene abandons the juice project altogether in order to stare at him. He can't tell what she's thinking. But then, his mother's expressions have always been inscrutable. Against all odds, they had both sort of fallen in love with St. John. At least, Cash did. He knows Irene had warmed to it as well. She went out fishing with Huck once in an attempt to get information. But she also took a second boat trip with him before she and Cash left. He supposes it's possible that her feelings have changed since they've been back home, and now the whole Caribbean represents an enormous, ugly deception that she doesn't want to revisit. And maybe she'd prefer that Cash not revisit it either. It's the idea that Irene might say no, might ask him nicely not to go, or forbid him to stay in the villa, that makes Cash realize how badly he wants to return and give life down there a shot. He won't stay forever, maybe just until summer.
Is this about the girl? Irene asks.
What? Cash says.
He can feel his face turning red. No, of course not.
Oh, Irene says, that's too bad. I like her for you, you know?
So, is it okay? Cash asks.
Yes, honey, Irene says. It's fine. The villa is just sitting there empty. Someone should use it. Let me buy your plane ticket and give you some money to get started.
Cash wants to tell her she doesn't have to. He's too old to be taking handouts from his mother. But the fact is, he's flat broke. Broker than broke.
Thank you, Mom, he says. Thank you so much.
Irene gives him a sad smile. I'm jealous, she says. Huck. $125,000. This is how much cash Huck and Ayers discover in the bottom drawer of Rosie's dresser. It's all banded up in neat bricks, just like in the movies. After they count the bricks, they count them again, announcing the amounts out loud as they go so they don't lose track. Then Huck says, come into the kitchen.
I don't think I can eat, Ayers says.
I'm not talking about barbecue, Huck says. I'm talking about rum.
Ayers shuts the drawer, and the blue Benjamins disappear. Huck ushers her down the hall. In the kitchen, he takes two shot glasses out of the cabinet and brings his trusty bottle of 18-year-old Flor de Caña, useful in most emergencies, down from the shelf. He pours two shots and gives one to Ayers.
I don't know what to say,
he admits, raising his own glass.
Me either.
They clink glasses and drink. He notices Ayers eyeing the barbecue spread out across the counter. She grabs a drumstick dripping with comeback sauce. Huck follows suit. No matter what the circumstances, Candy's is too tempting to resist. After Ayers leaves, taking one yellow dress and three pairs of white jeans with her, the rest of the clothes they should let Maya go through, Ayers says, as soon as she's old enough, Huck picks up the money, armful by armful, and stashes it under his bed. He's aware that it has remained undetected in Rosie's room, but he figures it's only a matter of time before Maya goes snooping. Maya will never voluntarily enter Huck's room. He's messy,
and Maya has declared on numerous occasions that, despite Huck's valiant effort with the laundry, his room smells like fish guts, rotten fish guts. After the money is beneath the bed, he stacks all the issues of Field and Stream and National Geographic that he's collected over the past 20 years around the bed so that if Maya does come poking around, she will see only that Huck is a pack rat. Money hidden, he feels a little better. He drives to Gift Hill to pick up Maya from school. $125,000 in cash in a dresser drawer. It's a lot of money, but it's not enough to kill two people over. That's Huck's thought as he pulls into the school parking lot. Maya is lingering by the gate with her friend Joni and two boys Huck recognizes but can't put names to. All four kids have their phones out, and they're laughing at something on the screen. Huck knows Maya sees him, and he also knows enough to be patient and not tap the horn or, God forbid, call out to her. That would be so embarrassing. Maya runs over to his window and he cranks it down.
Hello there, he says.
His voice sounds normal to his own ears, gruff, grandfatherly. All of his internal panic about having so much cash hidden under his bed is, he thinks, undetectable.
Are you not getting in?
Maya bites her lip. Would you take me and my friends into town so we can walk around?
Walk around and do what? Huck asks.
Cruz Bay is a small town consisting mostly of bars. 3 o'clock is when happy hour at Woody's starts, luring people off the beaches in the name of good, cheap rum punch. And at 4 o'clock, all of the excursion boats pull in and disgorge people who have been drinking all day, most of whom are interested in continuing their drinking on land. This is all well and good for the island economy. Cruz Bay in the late afternoons is one of the most festive places on earth, but it's not exactly a wholesome environment for a bunch of 12-year-olds. Maya shrugs. Get ice cream at Scoops? Walk around Mongoose? Maybe listen to the guitar player at the Sundog? He knows some Drake songs. Huck is pretty cool for a grandpa. He too knows some Drake songs.
All right, pile in, I guess. What time should I plan to pick you up?
Joni's mom will bring us home, Maya says.
Fine, Huck says.
If Julie is on board with the kids going into town, then Huck figures it must be all right. Joni climbs into the truck, giving Huck a fist bump, but the boys offer him scared sideways looks, like he's Lurch from the Addams Family. This actually cheers Huck up a bit.
Hey, fellas, he says. I'm Captain Huck. Remind me of your names.
Colton, says one. Bright, says the other. Colton and Bright. Huck has definitely heard both names before, so that's good. The four kids wedge themselves into the back seat of the truck's cab, leaving Huck to feel like very much the chauffeur. He nearly asks Maya to move up front, but he doesn't want to embarrass her, and he supposes that part of the fun is being smushed up against a boy. This is how it all starts, Huck thinks. 1 minute you're leg to leg with a boy in your grandpa's truck during a ride into town, and the next minute you're hiding $125,000 of that boy's illegally gotten dollars in your dresser drawer. Huck heads up the hill to Myra Keating, then takes a left on the centerline road. At every curve and dip, the kids hoot as though the thrill of the ride is brand new, even though they've all grown up driving on this crazy road. When they descend to the roundabout and Huck signals to go right toward Mongoose Junction, Maya says,
Actually, Gramps, can you drop us off at Powell Park? We're waiting for some Antilles kids to get off the ferry.
Antilles kids? Huck says.
Antilles is the private school over on St. Thomas.
Not those rascals.
One of the boys guffaws, and Huck can practically hear Maya rolling her eyes. Waiting for the Antilles kids is fine, Huck supposes. Powell Park attracts a colorful cast of characters, but it's perfectly safe to hang out there in the mid-afternoon. So why does Huck feel uneasy? He knew these days were coming. Maya wasn't going to stay a child forever. But he's not ready. He should probably acknowledge that he'll never be ready. He needs Rosie back from the dead. He needs Leanne. Ayers has offered to serve as a surrogate mother, but she has her own life, two jobs and a boyfriend, so how much can he really ask of her? Huck has gotten used to the solo life, but right now he could really use a partner. Irene? He immediately chastises himself for the thought. He must be out of his mind. That night, after Maya shows Huck her completed homework and then goes into her room to FaceTime Joni and giggle about God knows what, probably Colton and Bright or possibly a boy who goes to Antilles, Huck climbs into bed with his Michael Connelly novel. He's been reading this book since before Rosie died, which is an addling thought. When he first cracked open The Late Show a couple weeks ago, his life was one way, and now that he's on page 223, it's completely another. Now Rosie is dead. Dead. And he's hiding 125 grand under his bed. The book does the trick, though. Keeps him engrossed for a few chapters until his eyelids start to feel heavy. He closes the book and turns off the light. Sleep, he thinks. But he can't sleep. He might as well have a pile of uranium under the bed. The money feels radioactive. $125,000 in cash. Why? Eventually, he drifts off. When he's awakened by his alarm, his head aches and he's in a foul mood. In his day, this was known as getting up on the wrong side of the bed. Let's go, he calls out to Maya. I have a charter at 9, a bachelor party. Maya emerges from her room wearing a pink jean skirt, a black tank top, and black Chuck Taylors. She looks older, as though she aged 3 years overnight.
I thought you hated bachelor parties, she says.
Put on something else, Huck says. That top is too revealing and that skirt is too short.
What are you talking about? Maya says. I wear this outfit all the time.
You do? Huck says.
He has to admit he doesn't usually notice what Maya is wearing, and he has never commented on it before.
I guess maybe you're growing, because it looks too small.
Maybe you need new glasses, Maya says with a grin.
She peers into the frying pan where he's scrambling eggs.
Cut the heat. They're perfect now.
Huck snaps the burner off. It's an ongoing joke that Huck tends to overcook the eggs, and Maya feels about dry eggs the way that Huck feels about dry fish. No bueno.
Serve them up yourself, Huck says, and make your own toast. I have to get ready.
Maya stares at him.
Is this about yesterday?
Huck stops in his tracks. He's facing the refrigerator, where he's about to grab Maya's lunchbox, packed with a peanut butter and jelly, as per her request, because all of a sudden sandwiches made from freshly caught fish aren't good enough.
Yesterday?
Taking my friends to town, Maya says. You've been in a weird mood since then.
She's intuitive, he'll give her that. He can't very well tell her the truth, that what has put him in a weird mood is the 125 grand he found in her mother's room, but neither does he want her to think that he minds driving her and her friends around. If she believes that, she'll start asking someone else for rides, and he'll lose his window into her world.
That's not it, Huck says. I enjoyed taking you to town.
Oh, Maya says. What is it then? Is it Irene?
At this, Huck does turn around.
Irene?
You miss her, right? That's why you're grumpy?
Huck opens his mouth, but for the life of him, he can't think of how to respond. The night following Irene's departure, he made the mistake of drinking a couple of shots of Flor de Caña and saying some things to Maya that he should have kept private.
What exactly did he say?
Maybe something as innocuous as,
I've never seen a woman fish like that before.
Maybe something more revealing.
But did he say he had feelings for Irene? No.
Did he ever say he'd miss her?
No.
Huck nearly snaps, I'm not grumpy.
But he is, and it's not Maya's fault.
Sorry, nut, he says.
I'm just tired. I'm missing your mom. And your grandma, too, for good measure. And I'm dreading this bachelor party.
Maya opens her arms to give Huck a hug, which he gratefully accepts. He loves this child to distraction. She's all he has left. And he'll be damned if he's going to let whatever mess Rosie was involved in affect her.
Eat your breakfast, he says.
Adam is late getting to the boat, which normally ticks Huck off, but today he's grateful. He has to think. What does he do about the money? He's a human being, so part of him fantasizes about keeping it and slipping $500 here and $300 there into Maya's college fund. He's not rich. He might not even qualify as comfortable, but his house is paid off and so is the boat. He has money saved for a new truck once his old one finally dies, and he has a fund for boat repairs. The money, if he kept it, would be a cushion. A really soft cushion. He can't keep it. He has to report it. But to whom? He'll call Agent Vasco, he decides. He'll call her today, after the charter. But maybe he'll call Irene first. A dinghy putters up to the Mississippi. It's Keegan, the first mate from What a Catch, a friendly rival fishing boat, dropping off Adam.
Sorry, Cap, Adam says, climbing aboard.
He was up late talking to Marissa, Keegan says.
Huck pretends not to hear this last comment, as though ignoring it might make the situation go away. Marissa is the daughter of Dan and Mrs. Dan, the Albany couple from Huck's charter on New Year's Eve. Marissa is the girl who did not cast a line, the one who barely took her eyes off her phone screen the entire time they were out on the water. Adam asked the girl out for New Year's Eve, an act of desperation if Huck had ever seen one. But the date must have been a humdinger because after that, they'd been inseparable until Marissa left a few days ago. The day before yesterday, Huck said to Adam,
"Why pick a girl who doesn't like to fish?"
Adam scoffed.
You know how hard it is to meet a chick who actually enjoys fishing?
Huck nearly spoke up about Irene. The woman seemed to have taken up permanent residence in the front of his mind and on the tip of his tongue. But instead he said,
Maya likes to fish.
Adam said, Maya is 12. She'll grow out of it. Keegan putters away in the dinghy. Adam removes his visor, runs a hand through his hair, and gazes in the direction of St. Thomas, where they both see an airplane taking off, probably going back to the States.
Head in the game, Huck says. Check the lines.
I have to talk to you, Cap, Adam says.
Huck shakes his head. Afterward, please. We have a bachelor party today, and you know how I feel about bachelor parties.
Huck hates bachelor parties. 9 times out of 10, if someone calls looking to book the Mississippi for one, Huck will tell the person his boat is unavailable for the foreseeable future. With bachelor parties, something bad always happens. Huck keeps one case of Red Stripe on ice at all times, and one case only. Bachelor parties often bring an additional 30-pack of Bud Light, undrinkable, in Huck's opinion, as well as rum or tequila, or sometimes punch in a plastic gallon jug. Huck gives extra alcohol the side eye, but he has never flat-out forbidden it. That would be a fatal move for his TripAdvisor ratings, although he thinks to himself that what these kids really want is a booze cruise, not a fishing trip. He nearly always ends up with one participant completely jackwagon drunk, puking off the back. He's had guys fall off the boat, and he's had fistfights. Huck never gets involved in the fistfights. He just turns the boat around and drops the group at the National Park Service dock without a word, regardless of whether they've caught any fish. Huck agreed to book this bachelor party because he has been all but ignoring his business since Rosie died, and he needs to get back into some kind of groove. He pulls up to the National Park Service dock at 9:10, but the only people waiting are 4 gentlemen, Huck's age or maybe older. They're in proper fishing shirts and visors, and they have bags from the North Shore Deli, home of a roasted pork and broccoli rabe sandwich that Huck dreams about.
He wonders if these guys are waiting for what a catch and feels a stab of envy. Huck gives them a wave as he ties up and considers just poaching this foursome and letting Keegan and Captain Chris from What a Catch handle the bachelor party guys, who, Huck guesses, will show up late and hungover after a raucous night at the doghouse pub. One of the gentlemen, full head of snowy white hair, steps forward.
Captain Huck, he says, I'm Kyle McGuire.
Kyle McGuire? That's the name of Huck's guy. These four geezers are the bachelor party. Huck laughs with relief. He'd been expecting millennials with their hashtags and their GoPros and their swim trunks printed with watermelon margaritas.
Welcome aboard, Huck says.
It's the charter of Huck's dreams. The four geezers, Kyle McGuire, his brother Harry, and Grover and Ahmed, childhood friends from Worcester, Massachusetts, are in their 60s, like Huck, and Huck can tell right away that they are good guys. They grin with just the right amount of eager enthusiasm as they kick off their shoes without being asked, shake Huck's hand, and climb aboard the boat. Kyle, the groom-to-be, tells Huck he's a hospital administrator at Mass General and that he has a home on Nantucket, where he goes fishing two or three times a summer. Up there, it's striped bass, bluefish, maybe bonito and false albacore if you're lucky. Harry is a lawyer, Ahmed a retired ophthalmologist, and Grover a professor of business at the Kellogg School at Northwestern. Grover asks Huck about his USMC hat, and Huck talks about his tour in Vietnam. Turns out, Grover was over there around the same time.
Are you gentlemen okay going with offshore? Huck asks.
Let's do it, Kyle says. Huck decides to take the boat out to the spot that he and Irene fished. What the hell? Why not give it a try? The day is sunny and the water is flat. The men relax with beers. Ahmed chats with Adam, and Huck plays music. The Doors, Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones. They reach the coordinates where they found the school of Mahi before and start trolling. Come on, fish, Huck thinks. Maybe the luck he had with Irene will repeat itself. Kyle gets a bite first. He reels it in as Huck stands alongside in case he needs any help. It's a barracuda. They all gather around to admire it, then Huck throws it back. After that, it's quiet for a while, which is when some people on these trips grow antsy. Often, that's when Huck has to tell them that's why it's called fishing, not catching. Huck nearly describes to these four men the day that he and Irene had out here, 17 mahi, but he holds his tongue because it doesn't seem like history will repeat itself.
So, you're getting married, Huck says. Is this your first time?
No, Kyle says. Been married twice before.
First time to my college sweetheart. I have two boys from that marriage, but we split after 5 years. Then I met Jennifer, and we were married for 22 years. She died in 2014.
This story eerily parallels Huck's own. He'd married his first wife, Kimberly, when he got home from Vietnam, and they divorced 6 years later, after her second unsuccessful stint in rehab. Then he met Leanne, and they'd spent 20 blissful years together before she died in 2014.
So, who's the new gal?
Huck asks. He knows that Maya would likely object to his use of the word gal, finding it old-fashioned or possibly offensive.
Her name is Sheila,
Kyle says. He gives Huck a sheepish grin.
We met on the internet, match.com.
Really? Huck says. Rosie used to encourage Huck to try one of those dating services, but to him it was utterly pointless. Who was going to want to move to St. John? A week's visit, sure. 2 weeks, maybe. But that didn't make a life together. And no way was Huck moving back to the States. He didn't care if Christy Brinkley came calling.
Yep, Kyle says. She's a civil engineer. She builds bridges in the Bay Area, the kind of bridges that can withstand earthquakes. Her husband died of Lou Gehrig's disease 2 years ago. She has one son, grown up, who lives near me outside of Boston, so Sheila is moving east from Oakland and we're tying the knot. If you don't mind my asking, how long have you been dating?
9 months, Kyle says. He waves his beer can in the direction of his friends. They all thought I was rushing into things when I bought the ring after only 6 months. I can't describe it. We just clicked. I flew out there one weekend. She came to see me on Nantucket a couple weeks later. Then we went to Chicago, where she met Grover and he approved. Then we did a week in Napa. At Thanksgiving, she came to Boston and I introduced her to my kids. They loved her right away. I proposed when I dropped her off at the airport.
Are you worried about her moving in with you?
Huck asks. A week in Napa is one thing, he thinks. Sharing closet space is another.
I know it's a gamble, Kyle says, but I'm 64 years old and life gave me another chance to be happy. Only an idiot would say no to that out of fear.
Huck stares over the turquoise sheet of the water toward the verdant hills of St. John. Kyle must sense that his words have stirred something up in Huck, because he claps Huck on the shoulder and says,
"You hungry? We got enough sandwiches for everyone."
They catch another barracuda. Then Adam suggests heading over toward Little St. James, and Huck agrees. The spot he picked has lost its magic, apparently. In the next place they troll, Ahmed catches a decent-sized tuna. Then Harry brings in a wahoo big enough to serve as dinner, and Huck relaxes. He cracks open a Coke and turns up the Who's Baba O'Reilly and casts a line himself. He gets a fish on almost instantly and hands the line over to Grover, who reels in a second wahoo, bigger than the first. Then Kyle catches a tuna. Ahmed takes a nap in the shade. Huck overhears Adam talking to Grover about business school, and suddenly Huck knows what Adam wants to tell him. But he won't let it ruin the afternoon. At 2:15, it's time to turn the boat back. Kyle passes out Romeo y Julietas, and Huck gratefully accepts one. He loves Cuban cigars. Leanne absolutely forbade them, so Huck can't light up without feeling like he's indulging in a guilty pleasure. How does Irene feel about them? He wonders. Life gave me another chance to be happy. Only an idiot would say no to that out of fear. Huck thinks of the first time he saw Irene, her chestnut braid draped over one shoulder as she marched down the dock calling him Mr. Powers. Now that he knows her a little better, he realizes she doesn't mess around nor suffer fools, but still, it was impressive, the way she talked herself onto his boat. We just clicked. Had Huck and Irene clicked? He would have a hard time saying they hadn't. Angler Cupcake. There's nothing like the wisdom of a 12-year-old, Huck thinks. Maya was right. Huck misses Irene, and that's why he's grumpy. When they tie up back at the dock, Adam fillets the fish for the gentleman, and Kyle pours a shot of tequila for everyone. They clink glasses and throw back the shots. Kyle thanks Huck profusely and slips him a generous tip, which Huck nearly refuses because the guy has given Huck so much already. If nothing else, he has changed Huck's mind about bachelor parties. Temporarily, anyway. They shake hands and say their goodbyes, and Huck says maybe he'll see them in town over the next few days. It's not impossible, although Huck hasn't been out since Rosie died.
They were terrific, Huck says to Adam once they're gone.
He slips Adam one of the hundreds that Kyle gave him. Those are the kind of men Huck would have as friends, if he had time for friends. Adam stuffs the 100 in his pocket. Cap, he says. The boy looks green around the gills, downright seasick, as though he will be the one to upchuck off the back of the boat. And just like that, Huck is snapped out of the golden reverie that a good day out on the water provides. He's back to real life, the money under his bed, the FBI, and whatever Adam has to tell him. Huck decides to cut the kid a break and do the hard part for him.
You're leaving me? He says.
Adam nods morosely.
I'm moving to upstate New York to be with Marissa.
Upstate New York? Huck thinks. What did this girl Marissa do to him?
It's cold in upstate New York,
Huck says. It snows. A lot. And there's no ocean.
I love her, Adam says, and he swallows. I'm in love with her.
Huck nods. He yearns to tell Adam that, more than half the time, love dies. And it probably dies quicker in places like Oneida and Oneonta. But Huck won't be that curmudgeonly skeptic today.
They have lakes, Huck says. Great lakes. You can fly fish.
Adam looks so relieved that Huck's afraid the boy might try to kiss him.
Yeah, that's what I thought I'd do, he says, in the summer.
Huck lights a cigarette and inhales deeply.
So you'll leave in May then, or June?
A week from Tuesday, Adam says.
A week from Tuesday, Huck thinks.
Oneonta in January, Huck says. Must be love.
That night after dinner, fresh, perfectly grilled wahoo that even Maya agrees is sublime, Huck heads out to the deck with his pack of Camel lights and his cell phone. Agent Vasco or Irene? He decides on one, then changes his mind and decides on the other, then back again. Irene. He's almost more nervous about calling her than about calling the FBI. He is more nervous about calling her because he has no idea how the conversation will go. She answers on the first ring.
Oh, Huck, is that you?
Her voice stirs something in him. He exhales smoke.
It's me.
He pauses. He had planned to say, I'm calling to check on you, or I'm calling to see how you're doing. But instead, the words that fly out of his mouth are, I have a business proposition. My first mate, Adam, quit on me today, and I can't properly run my charter without a mate. So I'm calling to offer you a job. There's a pause long enough for Huck to take a drag off his cigarette. Consider the lights of the West End below and the cruise ship headed to St. Croix in the distance, and castigate himself for acting like a fool. He should have gone with, how have you been?
What does it pay? Irene asks.
He grins and tells her the truth.
$100 for a half day, $200 for a full day, he says, plus tips.
He clears his throat, plus fish.
That sounds fair, she says. When do I start?
He has to rein in the joy in his voice before he makes the second call. He clears his throat, takes a cleansing breath, lights another cigarette, and dials.
Colette Vasco.
Agent Vasco, this is Sam Powers calling from St. John. I'm Rosie's.
Yes, hello, Captain Powers, Agent Vasco says. I'm sorry, I don't have any further news.
I have news,
Huck says. He lowers his voice in case Maya happens to pop out of her room in search of some Ben and Jerry's brownie batter core.
I found $125,000 hidden in a dresser drawer in Rosie's room. I thought you would want to know.
Yes, Agent Vasco says. Yes, you're certainly right about that. What would be a good time tomorrow for me to stop by?
Baker. When he tells his school wives, Wendy, Becky, Debbie, and Ellen, that Anna has asked him to get a sitter for Floyd so that she and Louisa can take Baker to dinner at Indigo and civilly discuss arrangements, they all start talking at once.
Don't let them railroad you, Wendy says. Ask for full custody if that's what you want.
Debbie slides a business card across the table. Perla Pugey, Esquire.
My divorce attorney, she says. Pitbull.
We've agreed to do mediation, Baker says.
Using words like civilly and mediation nearly always means an ambush is coming, Becky says.
Baker slips the card into his pocket.
I'm dying to eat at Indigo, Ellen says. Their tasting menus are the talk of the city. It's neo-soul food.
I'm in, Wendy says. Let's book a table the same night, she cackles. That way, if things go south, you can come sit with us.
I thought Anna ate only pizza, Debbie says.
Didn't you tell me Anna hated going out to fancy places?
She was always too tired, Baker says.
But not anymore, Ellen says with an eye roll.
Call the lawyer, Debbie says,
and report back, Wendy says.
Also, take a picture if you can, Becky says.
Debbie swats her hand.
We sound like a pack of catty teenagers.
I want to see if Anna looks happy, Becky says. I want to see if she has that glow.
Imagine, Wendy says. Anna, happy. Ellen wasn't wrong. Indigo is a unique experience with its own set of rules and a robust social conscience, which must be why Louisa picked it. Baker assumes that Louisa picked it, since what Debbie said is true. Anna eats only pizza. There are only 13 seats at a horseshoe-shaped bar, making for a communal experience, which Baker figures is both good and bad. On the one hand, things can't possibly get too ugly in such a controlled environment, but on the other, their civil discussion of arrangements might become a group therapy session. They are, blessedly, placed at the far side of the horseshoe, with Baker agreeing to take the seat on the end in a relatively dim corner. Louisa is next to him, Anna on the other side of Louisa. This feels weird and wrong. Shouldn't he be sitting next to Anna so they can talk about Floyd? And yet, it's also symbolic. Louisa is, in fact, the person who came between Baker and Anna, as the seating now illustrates. They're asked to select their tasting menu. They can choose carnivore, omnivore, or pescatarian chordate. Pescatarian means fish, Baker knows. He hasn't a clue about chordate, but listed underneath is the word amphibian, which probably means frog's legs, but it's too risky to chance it. Baker chooses carnivore with a first course called turtlenecks and do-rags, and the ladies, women, choose omnivore and will enjoy a first course called Descendants of Igbo, which is apparently yams with marshmallows. This place is truly an alternate universe, but at least it serves as a distraction. Anna, not one for small talk, leans forward and says,
Louisa was offered a position in the neonatal cardiothoracic surgery department at the Cleveland Clinic, and she's going to take it. And she persuaded them that two heart surgeons are better than one, so they've offered me a job as well.
Turns out, they're even more excited to get the great Anna Schaefer than they are to get me, Louisa says, and she covers Anna's hand with her own. Baker gazes at the two of them. They seem like strangers to him, like people he's met at jury duty. Anna is wearing her hair down and it looks lovely, like a dark velvet curtain. Louisa's hair used to be dark and long like Anna's. Baker has known her long enough to remember this. But now she has cut it very short and dyed it platinum blonde. They're both glowing. They're both happy. It's obvious that they're in love, that they're a couple. None of the other 10 diners tonight would ever guess that Baker and Anna are the people who are married. Immediately after making this observation, he processes the words Cleveland Clinic. They're both taking positions at the Cleveland Clinic, which, if Baker isn't mistaken, is in Cleveland. He feels like he has to double check. Hospitals all have satellite campuses these days.
Are you talking about the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland? He asks.
Louisa's head bobs, and he notices her grip on Anna's hand tighten.
Yes, Baker, she says.
It's probably not her intent to speak to him like he's a moron, but that's pretty much what she's doing. We're relocating to Cleveland.
Not with Floyd, Baker says. You aren't taking my son to Cleveland.
That's what we wanted to talk to you about, Anna says. There's more than one way to look at this.
Oh, really? Baker says.
He runs his eyes along the horseshoe to the opposite side, hoping that he will see his four friends eating amphibians. He needs them now because it's becoming clear that this is an ambush. Anna and Louisa have accepted positions at the Cleveland Clinic. They're moving to Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes, really, Anna says.
The server arrives with Anna's and Louisa's descendants,
yams, and baker's turtlenecks and do-rags, which appears to be a crab dish, not actual turtles' necks. Louisa and Anna dig in, but Baker can't even remember how to use his cutlery.
Our first choice would be for you and Floyd to come to Cleveland.
What? Baker says.
You can do your job from anywhere, Anna says. You don't have to be in Houston.
But we have a house. Floyd has school. We have friends in Houston. A community. A life.
Anna scrapes yams out of the shallow bowl. The deepest roots we have in Houston are mine at the hospital, and I'm willing to pull those up for this opportunity.
Baker stares at his crab, fervently wishing that Wendy, Becky, Debbie, and Ellen were here so he could inform them that his friendship with them is, according to Anna, shallow, or at least not as deep as Anna's career. The woman is so cold, so dispassionate, Baker can't believe he ever decided to marry her. Good luck to Louisa.
You and Louisa go to Cleveland, Baker says. Floyd and I will stay here. I'll send him up to you on his vacations.
That's our third choice, Louisa says, a distant third because we'd obviously like to remain a cohesive family unit.
Baker very much resents her chiming in at all. She stole Baker's wife, and now she's dragging her to Ohio. It's clear that Louisa is maintaining some kind of utopian vision of the three of them as the parents in this cohesive family unit, with Anna and Louisa as the breadwinners, and Baker as Floyd's primary caregiver.
But we want to keep the transition as harmonious as possible for Floyd's sake. So we can try that option for the first year if you insist upon it. You and Floyd stay here and we'll set up a realistic visitation schedule, holidays and summers.
Great, Baker says. You can be the Disneyland parents. This is Debbie's term. Her ex-husband, JB, takes her kids only 3 weeks per year, to Martha's Vineyard over the summer, to Aspen at Christmas, and to a different European city each spring. Baker considers the two very serious, accomplished women, people, on his left. Sorry to say, they are no one's idea of Disneyland parents. And yet, this plan works for Baker, because he is not moving to Cleveland.
You should also know, Anna says, and for the first time during this unpleasant and confusing dinner, she seems ill at ease, that I'm planning on getting pregnant, Louisa finishes. She considers the yams and marshmallows on the end of her fork, using a sperm donor.
The words sperm donor should never be uttered during dinner, Baker thinks. He has just lost his appetite.
Their server takes advantage of the pause in their conversation to whisk away their first course plates, Baker's untouched, and set down the homogenization of mandingos, venison sausage with beets for Baker, and the belly of the beast, boar ribs, for the ladies. Women, people. Baker has some other words to describe them at this point, words that don't fall in the category of civilly discussing arrangements.
So Floyd will have a half-brother or half-sister, in a sense, and we obviously want them to have a relationship, Anna says.
Cohesive family unit, Louisa says again.
Those are her buzzwords, and it takes all of Baker's willpower to keep from shouting at her that Anna, Baker, and Floyd were, the family unit. Louisa is the interloper, the homewrecker. Baker reaches for his beer, which he's been too distracted to drink. He takes a long sip, buying himself time. Anna has left herself wide open here.
I thought you said you didn't want any more children, Baker says. You were adamant about it, in fact. And now you're talking about a baby.
Louisa will have the baby, Anna says.
And yet you want a cohesive family unit, Baker says. So you'll be co-parents.
Of course, Anna says, shrugging.
She doesn't meet Baker's eyes because, very likely, she doesn't want to provoke him into describing what having Dr. Anna Schaefer as a co-parent was like. It was like having no co-parent at all. But Baker decides he won't tell Louisa this. He'll let her find out on her own.
two busy surgeons at the Cleveland Clinic, one baby. What could go wrong?
Well, Baker says, congratulations.
He picks up his fork. Suddenly, the whole situation seems amusing, and maybe even fortunate. Anna and Louisa are leaving town. Floyd will see them for vacations and holidays, which on the surface appears sad and pathetic. He's a 4-year-old boy. He needs his mother. But Baker is in a position to know that Floyd doesn't need Anna. He's been fine this long without her. Maybe Anna will be more engaged as a parent when the job is taken in small bites. Anna smiles at him. Her glow returns.
Thank you for being so understanding, she says. And please know that whatever financial resources you want, we'll provide. You can keep the house. There will be support for Floyd and support for you as well.
He's being paid off, but he doesn't care. He cuts into his venison sausage. He can't wait to get home and call his friends. He starts with Ellen because, really, theirs is the closest relationship, and Ellen is a single mother by choice, so she is savvy and resourceful by nature. He tells her everything, including the esoteric menu items at dinner, and with each new revelation, she gasps. Louisa offered job at Cleveland Clinic. Anna offered job at Cleveland Clinic. Louisa and Anna moving to Cleveland. Louisa and Anna offering to move Baker and Floyd to Cleveland. Louisa and Anna offering to take on the role of Disneyland parents while Baker keeps Floyd in Houston. Louisa having a baby with sperm donor. Anna agreeing to parent. Anna and Louisa promising to support Baker and Floyd financially. At the end, Ellen says, on the surface, this sounds great for you, really great. Anna and Louisa are out of your hair. You get to keep Floyd in the house, and they're going to pay you.
But, Baker says,
doesn't it seem too good to be true? Ellen says, like something doesn't add up. I know Anna isn't the most hands-on mother, but is she really going to move 1,200 miles away from her son and see him only at Christmas?
And summers, Baker says weakly. He too feels uneasy now, but he can't tell if it's because he thinks Anna is going to renege and possibly sue him for custody, which is what it would take for her to get Floyd, or if he's just embarrassed about marrying a woman who really just isn't maternal at all. Listen, I know it sounds unconventional, but think about Anna. This scenario is perfect for her. She doesn't have time to parent. I'm concerned about Floyd spending the entire summer with her because you and I both know that means he'll have a full-time nanny. He's better off with me.
Agreed, Ellen says.
She takes a sip of what he can only assume is Eighth Wonder IPA. She's a craft beer fanatic, and says,
so my brilliant best friend mind now wonders why you would even stay in Houston. With Anna leaving, you're free to go wherever you want.
Ellen's tone is heavy with innuendo. She's the only one in the group that he's told about his father dying in the Caribbean, the $15 million villa, and heirs. She's the only one he's told about heirs. That night, the carnivore tasting menu churns in Baker's stomach as he scrolls through every reason why he shouldn't leave Houston for good and move down to St. John. He starts with the reasons he gave Anna. They have a house here. Well, the house is a house. He can sell it or rent it or leave it be until he sees how things work out down in the islands. He and Anna bought it outright when they moved from Chicago, so there's no mortgage, only taxes, insurance, and maintenance. Floyd has school. They have friends, a community, a life. Floyd is 4. He goes to Montessori. He's not a sophomore in high school. He's not even in middle school. If they leave Houston now, it's possible Floyd won't have any memories of the place, much less feel resentful about moving. Floyd can already read and count to 100. Baker should investigate the schools in St. John, make sure they're somewhere suitable. Friends,
community.
Baker is chairperson of the Children's Cottage annual benefit auction, which is in 2 weeks. Baker's work on the auction is basically done. All of the items have been solicited. He bought a table for $3,000 and invited all his school wives. He should really attend. But it's not necessarily a reason to stay. The auction will happen. The school will make money. The auction will be over. Will Anna object to Floyd living in the Virgin Islands? She's seen the villa. She knows it's comfortable. She'll be concerned about the schools. Baker will look into it first thing in the morning. Maya goes to school. Maya is Floyd's aunt. Okay, that's a little weird, but maybe not. It's late, Baker is tired, everything seems weird. Louisa wants to have a baby, essentially a half-brother or half-sister for Floyd. Baker would love to have more kids. Heirs. Baker knew the instant he saw her that he wanted to marry her. They'd ended on bad terms, really bad, and she said she was back with Mick. That means she's having sex with Mick, Baker thinks, maybe even this very second, which is enough to make him sick. But he needs to think realistically about sex. Sex is ephemeral. Once it's over, it's over. Sex is not a lasting connection. It's only real while it's happening. It's not love. Besides, Mick cheated on Ayers, and once a cheater, always a cheater. If Baker is confident of anything, it's that Mick will blow it, and Baker will be there to show Ayers how she deserves to be treated. Ayers hadn't wanted to get serious about Baker because he was a tourist. If Baker moves into his father's villa, he will be a tourist no longer. Bright and early the next morning, Baker books 2 tickets to St. Thomas with a return flight in 2 weeks so that he and Floyd will arrive back the day before the auction. Then, assuming all goes well on St. John, after the auction they will move back permanently. This trip will be an exploratory mission, a toe dipped in to test the waters. He calls Paulette Vickers to let her know that he and Floyd will be down on Saturday to stay at the villa for a few weeks, and might she be able to meet him at the dock with the keys?
Certainly, Mr. Steele, she says. I'm happy to know you're using it. A beautiful villa like that shouldn't sit empty. I asked your mother if she wanted me to rent it, and she said to hold off for the time being.
My mother is overwhelmed, Baker says. She doesn't need more to worry about. I'll handle all things relating to the villa from now on.
He wonders if he's overstepping, but all of the goodwill he's put in with Paulette is paying off because she doesn't question it.
Very good, she says. I'll meet you at the ferry dock on Saturday with the keys.
Baker hangs up and feels an elation so strong he could levitate. The only string tying him to earth is Irene. Baker should call her and tell her his plans. But what he just told Paulette is true. Irene is overwhelmed. She doesn't need one more thing to worry about. She doesn't need to fret about Baker and Floyd on St. John or about Anna relocating. Then again, Irene had been perfectly clear that she would not tolerate any more secrets. Secrets are lies, Irene said. Baker's trip to St. John isn't a secret. Of course it's not a secret. Paulette knows he's coming, and before he and Floyd leave, Baker will have to tell Anna. Once Baker is down there and settled in, he'll call Irene. This will give her a few more days of relative peace. That's the kind thing to do.
Rosie. February 21st, 2006. My life is a house that has been ransacked. My heart, which I had so recently reclaimed as my own, has been stolen again. Some might say I'm being careless with it. Friday afternoon was the start of President's Day weekend, which brings nearly as many tourists as Christmas and Easter now because schools in the Northeast, Massachusetts, New York, and a few of those other tiny, densely packed states, give their students a winter break. The problem with the visitors who can afford to come when the weather is the most inhospitable at home is that they tend to be demanding. They want their Caribbean experience to be just so. The sky must be clear, the mangoes ripe, the cocktails strong and delivered right away. Caneel Bay was at maximum.